You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Sally.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm all right. Excited to be with you.
Well, I'm excited for you to be excited to be with me.
I'm excited. You're excited. I'm excited.
Well, you know, my reply, never mind. So let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and audio podcast. You're Sally Cohn, familiar to many people probably as a personage on CNN, formerly a personage on Fox, a rare combination of resume items. We'll get to that. It's relevant to the book you've written that we're going to talk about called The Opposite of Hate. Why don't we leave people in suspense right now as to what the opposite of hate is? The answer may not be as simple as they think, may not be as simple as love or empathy. We'll get to that, but let's leave them on the edge of their seats. Subtitle is A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity. And it grows out of both your personal journey and our times, right? I mean, the moment we're in, the political polarization, the hatred of various people by various people. Is that fair to say?
It is, in fact. It just so happened that it was a topic. I mean, look, I was someone who considered myself an advocate and an activist against hate as a general concept, hate in its institutional and policy forms for most of my life. And it just so happened that when I started to encounter and become more and more aware of my own hate, the ways in which I was feeding into consciously or unconsciously those same or similar dynamics, happened to be happening at the same time as a country we were having more and more open struggles with hate, certainly in recent political events. And so it was unfortunate timing all around, I guess.
Yeah. So before we get into like the your personal journey part, do you have a view on the extent to which the hatred problem is symmetrical? By that, I mean, I'm pretty sure most people who are paying attention would say there's on both sides of the kind of ideological divide in America, or you might be better put the kind of Trump divide. I mean, there's pro-Trump, there's anti-Trump. On both sides, there's a fair amount of hatred. Do you find that it's roughly equal in magnitude and also in kind of? Hey, is it the same kind of hatred?
Yeah, that's an outstanding question. And no, I don't think it's equal. I do have an opinion that is both informed by experience, informed by talking to people on both sides of the aisle, so to speak, in terms of the hate and the volume of hate they've received, but also informed by research and evidence. And there is, in fact, research that, for instance, there is more hate spewed in right-wing media than in left-wing media. There is evidence that there is more hate directed at women, people of color, queer folks on the internet than, for instance, straight folks, white folks, men. And, you know, look, and at the same time, I think sort of two things. One, that who did it worse than first? Unfortunately, I mean, we'd like it to matter in a perfect world where everything was fair, it would matter. But unfortunately, we don't live in a fair world, and someone has to stop it. And the fact is that even though we all don't do it the same, we all tend to do it, and we often use the other side's hate as a rationale or a justification for ours. And that, to me, also has to stop. Now, again, I also don't think it's proportional in the sense that hate without power, institutional, cultural, political power is very different than hate with institutional, cultural, political identity power. So again, but you know, if we get stuck in that, the reality is we could debate that forever. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in debating solutions.
Right. Now, of course, if I were on the right, I would ask, who did this research that showed there's more hatred coming from the right, and what is their ideological persuasion? But I'll just leave that as a footnote and move on to the fact that you have personal experience in what some people on the left would consider one of the great hatred-generating machines in America, Fox News, that's at least the view of some people on the left. Talk about your experience there. First of all, how you came to be there. You don't fit exactly the standard Fox talking head profile.
Everyone there isn't a gay lefty. I just
most people are, but then there's Sean.
They just don't know it yet.
But you're right. It's mainly a lefty lesbian kind of channeling. Right?
I know. They just don't know it yet. You know. I mean, it's a very one of those girl meets Fox kind of stories where, you know, one day you're a community.
Well, there's only one of them, so how did this one go?
Everybody doesn't have the story. One day I was a community organizer. I'd love that work, traveling around the country, helping, people work together and connect and make changes in their communities, their workplaces, their schools at the state and national level. And one day I was speaking at a conference and someone who was in the media came up to me and said, "We have to get you on television." And I said, "No, we do not." I had like zero interest in that. I didn't like television. I owned a television. I was pretty sure that the, you know, entertainmentification of news might be our downfall, might still be. But long story short, I, you know, sort of decided, she was very persuasive. I decided I'd give it a try and at least I'd be a more media savvy organizer. And then I realized I liked it. Is a lot like organizing, except that instead of 10 people in a church basement, I got a million people on television. But it's the same idea of engaging and translating and activating people.
Mm-hmm.
So
I interrupt and ask you the question. I would have asked Alan Combs if I had ever talked to him. You know, he was the lefty who did the point counterpoint with Sean Hannity. And the question would be, did you ever feel you were a tool of a propaganda machine? In other words, these people know what they're doing. If you weren't serving their purposes, you might not be there. Was that an issue?
I mean, there's different ways to answer that, right? Depending on how cynical I'm feeling in a given day. You know, look, no one ever told me what to say. No one ever scripted it out. You know, the fact of the matter is that Fox, at least certainly under Roger Ailes when I was there, was very clear that it had two missions. It wasn't very clear, but it was clear to anyone watching that they had an ideological agenda, but they also had a goal of being entertaining and they wanted good television. And they knew that, you know, people who would just roll over were not good television. Now, was the game always in a way rigged? Yeah, it was. I didn't think of it as being a tool. And I mean, look, you're not asking questions I didn't ask myself and didn't have conversations with all my friends at the time who were people trying to take down and shut down Fox News, to get their perspectives on this. But you know, look, I mean, when you go into a rigged fight, right? Or let's not even call it a fight. Let's call it a stage, right? Cause it's really just a stage and you know, you're playing a part but the truth is there's still an audience. And, you know, it's like why people say they rob banks because it's where the money is. Well, as someone who believes in persuasion and change and advocacy, I went on Fox News because it's where the people are. Mm-hmm. And at the time, by the way, it was also where most of the Democrats were. More Democrats watching Fox than CNN and MSNBC combined at the time.
Really?
CNN is doing much better now. Thank you very much. But that was true, right? So, and look, I wasn't there because I was going to ever change Sean Hannity's mind. Just wasn't going to do it. And I wasn't going to change the 20-30% of his viewers who are just like him. Super, you know, on the right, firm in their convictions. But that's not everybody watching. And my own both belief in humanity as well as my lived experience said that there were times where people were able to listen. People are able to listen. Our views are, in fact, still shaped and formed. And often what's hard is that we don't get the chance to have nuanced, accessible conversations about complicated issues that allow for movement, learning, growth, change. And look, I believe in change. So I wanted to give people the benefit of the doubt and start engaging in those conversations.
Okay. So there's a kind of a breakthrough moment, I guess, of sorts that you had with Sean Hannity where he said, something kind of unflattering about gay people or maybe gay marriage or something. And you said, you said something like, are you saying your family's better than mine? And he purported to have not realized that you were gay and like apologized off the air. Right. I mean, is that the story?
Yeah. I mean, and look, I give people the benefit of the doubt. And here's the thing, you know, I also spent a lot of time in this book. I interviewed ex-neo-Nazis and former terrorists, but I also talked to people who've interviewed and researched current neo-Nazis and current terrorists. I talked to my own Twitter trolls who can be unimaginably vicious. And you know what the truth is? By and large, most people don't think they're mean. Most people don't mean to be mean.
They think that if they know they're being mean, they think you deserve it.
They don't think that they're interpersonally mean. I don't know how to explain it, because things that you would think are just self-evidently mean at a personal level, people don't tend to be mean. I mean, they think they're protecting themselves or they're protecting their kids. You know, there's complicated rationales, but they never actually say like, yeah, I meant to hurt your feelings. Like, nobody sets out thinking they do. They have other motivations, other lenses, other valences, whatever. And so, look, I mean, the fact of the matter is sort of like your kickoff question. I went to Fox News just figuring I had entered the belly of the beast. And here are these people who believed all these things I thought to be hateful. And I figured they would be just completely, totally hateful people. And when they weren't, not that they don't still support things that are hateful, not that I don't still disagree with them, but when they weren't, 100% hateful and actually were complicated, messed, sometimes kind, caring, compassionate people, that really messed with my worldview, to be honest, and my sense of self.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know who Greg Gutfeld probably is on Fox News, and he had me on his podcast when a book came out, then I had him on mine, and then now I'm on his again, and I like him. I mean, and I feel kind of bad about that. And I catch a lot of, like, when I had him on, it's like, don't you understand? He said this and this and this and this. And it's a strange thing, liking someone across the great tribal divide.
I think it's a, can I just say, Bob?
Sure.
I think it's a beautiful thing, right? And I'm not, listen, this is clear. I'm not giving anyone a pass on their politics, their ideology, the things they've said, the things they've supported. But I do want to believe, and look, this is why I'm a progressive, because I believe fundamentally in the equal dignity and humanity of all people. And then the question becomes, can I actually live that belief in the way I conceive of and treat all people? Because usually we do it just for the people on our side or the people like us, and right. And then we kind of have this asterisk, this disclaimer. Well, yeah. I really think all people are good and equal, but those people, they've been acting so bad that I'm gonna, and to me, first of all, if you let the other side define your values, you're letting them have more power than they deserve. And second, look, the only way I can see, we have massive institutional systemic injustices and inequalities in our country. The only way I can see to changing them is when people change, right? And I don't know how people change if you don't give them the invitation to and engage with them in ways that lead to change.
But let me give you a tougher case. I think a tougher case, which is Ben Shapiro. Now, I know you did some kind of event with Ben Shapiro, and the issue I'm going to raise here is like, are there some, and in a way it's relevant to the whole deplatforming question and speech code question, are there some people who say things such that we should exclude them from polite discourse until they really say, like, I'm sorry? So what Ben Shapiro famously tweeted in 2010 was the following: Israelis like to build, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. This is not a difficult issue. And then # settlements rock. Now, that seems like pretty open bigotry to me. Now you tell me he made a kind of amend subsequently, and I'll tell you what he did. Quite recently, he wrote something. I mean, it was kind of clear that this was becoming a problem for him, that he had done this. He was part of this, like, intellectual dark web thing. I don't know if you know about them, but they, you know, wanted him to be in, you know, but he was, I think it was a little bit of a problem that he had said this. So he wrote this thing that's like, okay, you know, it was something like less than smart things I've said. And he went through kind of his history. What he said about this was, he said, look, for starters, you know, people read this like as if it was in isolation. Let me just put it in context. Here's what I tweeted right after. And first of all, and I got on his case about this on Twitter, because first of all, that was, in my view, quite disingenuous, because if you looked at what happened, this tweet sat there for an hour. It was not part of a thread. Then he got so much blowback, he started to walk it back. So it's not as if that people had read it out of context. This was a standard utterance. Secondly, and this blows my mind, but when he walked it back, you know what he said? He said, I shouldn't have said Arabs. I meant Palestinians. So he had just, and I almost can't wrap my mind around how a guy trying to do damage control thinks it's better to say my bigotry is confined to a slightly smaller ethnic group. So I'm sorry if I'm getting a little, but.
No, you're fine. You're raising a larger question.
But counsel me on this. How should I feel toward him? I mean, when I think of him, I like to think I don't really openly hate people. And usually when I see the impulse welling up, I try to just kind of observe it and let it go. But if it's hard for me to imagine me having a conversation with him if he does not do an honest reckoning and just admit that he has these feelings toward this group, perhaps because of an affinity for Israel, whatever else, whatever it is, that he shouldn't have, you know, the bad part got a hold of him for that moment.
Yeah, I know.
Go on.
All right, so listen, if Ben's watching, hi, Ben. Ben, by the way, we did do a debate together. He mopped the floor with me. Because it's one of the speaking things you regret, because, you know, one of the things I learned about Ben is he will not stay on topic. I prepared for a topic, and he took a few, you know, he made it personal, but whatever.
He'll be happy to hear, by the way, that there's a YouTube video actually called Ben Shapiro Uses Logic to Destroy Sally Cohn on Institutional Racism. This is a thing, by the way, that feeds into the kind of hatred ecosystem. There's a whole genre of YouTube things where they just say our side killed this.
Yeah, I know. But in fairness, we do that too. So here's what I will say, without getting into the particularities of Ben. I mean, this is interesting because I had that debate with Ben after he'd sent that tweet. I actually didn't know about that tweet until just now. So there's one level here, which is, are we supposed to know about and vet every single thing about every person we engage with? I'm putting that aside for a second. There's also another problem here about Twitter, which is, I'm just going to say, this is in no way, shape, or form a defense of Ben, but there are certain things Ben's tweeted I agree with. There's a lot more probably he's tweeted that I disagree with. Most of them are innocuous. They're things about his kids, his pets, or I don't know, whatever. And this, judging people by the worst thing that they've ever done is, to be honest, to me, maybe we could argue it's morally consistent with conservatives, although certainly, you know, one could argue against that, but I do not think that's morally consistent behavior for progressives. You know, for those of us who believe in forgiveness and redemption and decriminalization and all of these things. So, now, that being said, two other points. One, I have always said, let's not focus on the leaders as much as the followers. And this is one of the things, look, that the right does, but I guess we do too, is you pick the one example, the worst example, I'm not so, people will ask me, because now I'm like the hate news. Can I hate Donald Trump? I said, I don't care if you hate Donald Trump. I care if you hate his followers, right? Donald Trump's one person. We're talking about millions of people. And you're ascribing this, everything that one person did to everyone who follows him. And that is, to be honest, this is true of Sean. This is true of Ben. This is true of everyone on the right. I worry less about them because we're talking about 10 or 12 of them, right? I worry about them.
But they do have disproportionate influence.
No, that's right. But I don't want to ascribe every single thing. Like, I don't want to assume that everyone, let me rephrase this differently. Trump may be a hopeless cause. I don't think his followers are. I don't think his followers aren't him, right? And that's an important foundational concept to grasp, right? That people actually are more I look at the evangelical Christian women, the Times just profiled, but who are coming out in support of Beto O'Rourke against Ted Cruz in the Texas Senate race. Like, that's a big deal. And this is the same reason why, look, I think, for instance, it is fundamental that abortion rights be part of the Democratic Party platform. But I welcome, anti-abortion people into any tent, right? Like, I actually believe, and I would rather, let's pick another example. Ann Coulter. Horrific on issues of immigration and race. Just getting worse and worse, by the way. Incredibly supportive on gay rights. Now, what would I rather? I'm still going to hold her to task on immigration stuff at absolutely pretty much every other issue. But would I rather her be anti-immigrant and anti-gay, right? Like, I don't know. I'm willing to now. Okay, so that was point one. Point two. So don't hold the followers to the same standard as the, give a little more leeway or generosity to the followers. Number one. Number two. Look, this always comes down to ostensibly the Hitler question, right? Which is like, would you sit down and talk to him? Would you debate him? Would you, if you're cable news, would you have him on, right? And this was really the issue that played out in the 2016 election, which is cable news and television and media in general gave airtime to Trump because they figured, well, if we air these horrible things he's saying, sunlight's the best disinfectant and it will solve it. And it ended up not being true. In fact, giving him airtime may have been what helped him get elected. So there's a paradox, and I'll be honest, I'm incredibly grateful it's not my job to decide. Because, you know, I think it's ridiculous, for instance, when people protest a little while back, David Remnick of The New Yorker was going to sit down and do an interview on a stage with Steve Bannon. People protested. They canceled it. I think that's ridiculous. This is the job of the media. And you know, I want to see someone like Remnick, push Steve Bannon on his thinking. On the other hand, where we draw that line,
right?
I'm pretty sure that people who listen to Ben Shapiro or the people who vote for Trump are not them. But where we draw the line there in terms of who would I be on a stage with, who would I invite to engage with, that's a very, very hard question.
Right. I think it's challenging because almost all of us would draw the line somewhere. I mean, for example, I think the speech code that has effectively prohibited until recently maybe the use of the N-word is a good thing. And that involves saying there's people we're not going to talk to. If you are known to derogate African Americans using that word and so on, you don't get on the major platforms. That was the rule in America for a long time. And I personally think in a case like that, speech codes have value. On the other hand, and here I guess I'm segueing to my question about what you think a lot of liberals may have wrong about Trump supporters, because I know one thing that at least some Trump supporters react against is a speech code that they view as overly broad. I mean, political correctness is an issue that he is known to have deployed successfully. So, I'm not asking you necessarily.
I would be careful.
How you think the your characterization of Trump voters, what motivates them, the extent to which they harbor hatred, might differ from that a lot of progressives harbor, the view that they
hold. Well, so first of all, I'd be very careful. I actually am not a big fan of speech codes specifically, right, in any kind of formal sense. I'm a pretty strong free speech absolutist, and that's why these conversations for me are hard.
Saying anyone should be arrested for using the N-word. That would be a violation of the First Amendment. That would be an infringement of free speech in the strict sense. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about informal things. But anyway,
yes. Well, now I know, but because there are actual things called speech codes on campuses, et cetera, I just want to be sort of, let's be clear about that. Number one. Number two, political correctness is a fascinating topic. And the reason it's a fascinating topic is because it's actually never been in any kind of, it's been retroactively defined. We have to remember that political correctness began in the 80s as a taunt. It was a tease from one leftist to another about being too puritanical or high and mighty about their leftism after the waves of the 60s and 70s. But it was a warning. It was a tease. It was a taunt. It wasn't held up as an ideal. And in the 90s, the right picked it up as though the left was affirmatively championing it and turned it and weaponized it, turned it into an attack. And then the left kind of went back somewhat half-heartedly and honestly half-fast and tried to, you know, like retroactively claim an idea that it had never actually championed in the first place. So the problem is when we talk about political correctness, we don't really know what we're talking about. If we're talking about the idea that we should use language that conveys basic respect and equal dignity, well, people are pretty in favor of that, actually. Mm-hmm. I suspect people are pretty in favor of that on the left and on the right. And I have, you know, there hasn't necessarily been polling on this, but there's anecdotal experience. You talk to people, even people who say really nasty things, and they say, I don't mean to be hateful. I don't want to be hateful. And I'm going to take them at face value for that. Give or take, right? We can get into the unconscious and all of that. But what political correctness has come to mean, come to be a stand-in for, is effectively a sort of cultural affirmative action. A notion that is built on 40, 50 years of the Republican Party ginning up fear and hatred, in particular racial fear and hatred and resentment, out of some notion that the Democrats, the left, are helping certain groups of people, women, people of color, immigrants, cut the line, so to speak, in the American dream. And that is, apart from the fact that that's not even accurately what that muddles the vision and agenda of the left, which has less to do with any cutting a line in particular, but actually making sure that there is a fair process in which everyone has equal opportunity. In other words, making a line, making as opposed to a dog pile, which is what we have now, where the people on the top are the people who are most likely to be born onto the top. Apart from that, it's not the accurate definition, because political correctness just becomes a proxy for all this other stuff. I think the other thing that's true is that when Donald Trump and even sometimes people like Ben Shapiro use it, they're wielding it in a, like they want to be deliberately offensive. They actually are testing the lines, testing the limits. They want to be deliberately offensive. And I don't think most people, I don't think most people want to be offensive. I just don't. Mm-hmm. Or at least I hope not.
Okay. So the problem of hatred per se, it's a subtle thing. I mean, as you've kind of alluded to already, first of all, a lot of time you don't recognize it when you're doing it. I mean, it's something that distorts your vision, and we're not designed to like recognize when our vision is being distorted. We're designed mm-hmm. to like buy into the distortion, and hatred is one of the things that does the distorting. Then if we do recognize that we hate someone and say, I hate that person, we pretty much always think we have valid grounds. There's a reason. You never say to somebody, why do you hate them? They go, I don't know. I just, you know, it's just one of these things. I hate them. And then there's just the degrees of the subtle ways this plays out, like on social media, where you see like a tweet that reflects unfavorably on the other side and you retweet it unreflectively precisely because you like it in this, you're drawn to it. It seems to me the problem is a very subtle one, and you have taken it upon yourself to do something about it. And you've even talked to people on the other side. You've talked to people who were your troll tormentors online. You've made a point of getting in touch with them, phoning them. How do you approach, like, what's your basic pitch?
How do you talk to my trolls?
What's that?
You mean in terms of trying to talk to trolls?
No, or
you
mean in terms of trying to
pitch
talk,
against, pitch
whether
against
on your side or their side, given how subtle the problem is, and yeah. hard it is to put people in touch with all of its dimensions as they play out in their own heads. What do you say? I mean, when you're out there, you know, trying to win converts, whether they're on the left or on the right, what do you say?
Well, I mean, the first thing is look, hate doesn't feel good for anyone doing it. So that's the first thing. This isn't some selfless, mercenary call, right? This is like, hate's bad for you. It's bad for your health. It's bad for your psyche. It makes you, it doesn't feel good to feel so despondent about your fellow human beings. So that's the first reason. The second is it is actually, I think the case that, again, we could argue, sounds like you and I would agree, but one could argue about who did it worse than first. And, you know, what I have experienced on all sides is that, first of all, everybody tends to think the other side, their other side did it worse than first. And second, that they then use that as a justification, as you said, for then being more hateful. And it's, look, hate is never the answer to hate. Injustice is never the answer to injustice. Cruelty is never the answer to cruelty. It just doesn't, like, by putting more hate in the world, you don't get rid of hate. You create more hate. And again, even if you're doing it to a lesser degree, reactively, you know, you can pat yourself on the back, that you're not as bad as, you know, you name it, and then be better. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, actually, God, I just quoted Melania Trump, which really hurts every time I say that, but you know, she's got that one little thing right, which is we actually all can be better. And, you know, I had a lot of experiences right after the 2016 election hanging out with, you know, lefty friends at dinner parties or in bars after the 2016 election. It was a lot of bars and like at 10 a.m. And, you know, people would be sitting around. My liberal friends and myself would be sitting around saying, God, those Trump supporters, they're so racist. They're so Islamophobic. They're so hateful, and I hate them. You know, you're right. You know, you're right about the larger dynamics, the institutional, dynamics, the systemic dynamics of hate in our country, the ways in which the Republican Party historically and Donald Trump in particular have exacerbated and exploited hatred for political reasons, and two wrongs don't make a right. Mm-hmm. And somebody has to take the high road. And God, please don't let Donald Trump define our values, because he did it. It's okay for us to do it.
Well, right. And to some extent, isn't that kind of a tactical question? In other words, to what extent do you say to people, if at all, you got to realize you're playing into his hands? I mean, he's trying to convince his base that you hate them. You know, so I'm not sure how much sense it makes to keep hating them in a super conspicuous way.
That's valid. But again, I'd rather define my values not in reaction to Trump's strategy or agenda, but independently, which is, look, I believe all people are equal. I believe all people are good,
so
decent.
It's more of a moral argument than a tactical one.
Well, it's actually both. I mean, incidentally, well, it is both moral and pragmatic. It is unfortunately not always a short-term pragmatic argument, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I, you know, it may not, social media, cable news, elections, like, it is not always true that the nice, decent path is always going to get the most eyeballs, the most clicks, the most votes.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, there is, in some way, there is a short-termism issue, perhaps. And yet I also, we've seen in our lifetimes, not too recently, we've seen candidates who have taken the high road, and been successful. We've seen, you know, media that has, right? I mean, it does exist. But yes, it is actually an investment in both the moral conviction that people are decent and good and capable of decency and goodness and change and the practical understanding that the only way people have ever changed is because they were given an opportunity to and felt welcome to, as opposed to feeling hated into it. Mm-hmm. I know people who've changed in their lifetimes. From whether it's these ex-neo-Nazis and ex-terrorists to people who were really homophobic 10, 20 years ago.
And is there a basic kind of thing that brings the change? Is it contact with the other or contact under certain circumstances?
Contact with the other in moments of startling, eye-opening kindness. It's when you realize that someone, that the other is not how they have been portrayed or stereotyped. And when that other shows you the kind of grace, not only that you never thought they were capable of or that group was capable of, but that you then suddenly realize you yourself, you kind of catch your own hypocrisy. And again, look, to your point, it isn't fair. It's not, it's like, it's asking, if we understand that injustice, cruelty, hate is not equally distributed, that there tend to be certain groups, women, people of color, immigrants, Muslims, Jews, who are on historically the receiving end of it, it isn't fair to then say, you know, hey, this is the moral, spiritual, practical quest you have to take on. That's why I think it's important for people who have more positional power to be, you know, upstanders and interrupters and advocates and allies. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's about choosing the kind of world you want to live in. And are you going to make that world through your moral action?
Right. By the way, on the tactical versus moral kind of question, I find that often when you look at like even like kind of ancient scriptural guidance, there turns out to be a little more tactics in there than you might think. I mean, the Buddha repeatedly makes the point that kind of, I think you kind of made, but that like, as a practical matter, hatred does not bring an end to the hatred that provoked it. It's you know, indifference in the fate of hatred is more likely to bring an end to it. And then there's this verse from, I think the book of Romans, but the Apostle Paul says this part is familiar. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. Here's the rarely quoted next line, okay? The whole thing is, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. That's, that's like,
I like that.
Exactly what they mean, but they obviously mean you will thwart your, you know, if the enemy is hating like in a vacuum and not getting the hatred back, there's something.
Oh, I got to write that one down. I like that. That's right. And I mean,
it's great. It's also in the Old Testament. Paul was drawing on Old Testament scripture when he said that. So let me ask you, it's this is a particular version of getting people to examine their own hatred. I mean, the people on anti-Trump people love to think of Trump supporters as racist and bigots. Not all of them think that way, but there is a tendency. And in fact, like on Twitter and social media, you know, there's been two kinds of outcomes of studies of Trump voters, and some emphasize like economic variables, and it's like stagnant wages seem to be what drives support for Trump, and then others emphasize, you know, threats to ethnic identity and maybe out-and-out bigotry. And there's a tendency among many people to kind of dismiss the first kind of explanation and embrace the second kind. And my own view is that that is itself a function of, if not hatred, some kind of bias, some kind of desire to have this reassuringly loathsome enemy, right? And not to mention the fact that the two are not mutually exclusive. I mean, economic variables, bigotry, and so on. But I'm wondering, there's two ways to, are you more inclined to go about it by questioning the stereotype progressives have of Trump voters, or are you more inclined to say, look, we're all bad, they may be bad, and let go of it, or both?
I mean, it's somewhere probably in between the two, right? I think that the way we tend to engage right now are sorts of forms of public discourse, which are predominantly cable news and social media, are not at the moment designed to transforming the kinds of conversations and relationships and engagement that lead to transformation. Largely, by the way, because that happens in person, face-to-face. Now, there are examples of people whose worldviews have been changed and challenged by social media, so it's possible. I talk about some of them in my book. But you know, we know that meeting people, knowing people, is key to having open minds about the groups that those people represent. We know that to be true. right? We saw, for instance, in this country that support for gay rights increased exponentially the more and more people actually knew someone who was gay. Not to say that assimilation, you have to, but like, you just saw that people don't always fit the stereotypes, and certainly they don't fit these horrific stereotypes and demonizations that I've been fed. So I think actually knowing people, actually talking to people, statistics show that we know far fewer we have people, period, let alone have close friends who are on the other side of the political aisle. And that's a problem. Because part of the reason I'm able to understand that all Trump voters aren't monsters is because I have friends who are Trump voters. And that's point number one. Point number two, look, I don't agree with everything the person I voted for in 2016, for darn sure. And I think it's fairly overly simplistic to assume that on the other side. And then point three, we have a really hard time as human beings, but in particular in our country, I think because of our overemphasis on individualism, we talk about structural problems and systems, like how the Republican Party has for 40, 50 years plus, systemically pushed racial fear-mongering and racial resentment on the voting public. And then when that, you know, comes home to roost, so to speak, and said voters elect someone like Donald Trump, the same people who've been talking about racial dog whistles and all of these, you know, this sort of systemic problem on the part of the right say, oh, well, those voters are racist, intrinsically, inherently racist. And I think it's partly because it makes it easier, right, as you suggested, but it's also because we just can't wrap our heads around, well, why did they fall for it and I didn't, and why do they, right? And when we really start to interrogate that, part of the problem is when you really start to interrogate it, for instance, if you're a white person like me, you go, oh, okay, wait a second, hang on, I have fallen for some of what they fell for, mm-hmm. right? I do believe these myths and these ideas, and right? And I
well,
do have these biases.
One of those may be the idea that all Trump supporters are like that. That is a form of essentialism, which people on the left are, a word people on the left are fond of deploying when they're complaining about bigotry that they see on the right. But to think of Trump voters, to even have an image of Trump voters is, first of all, too simple because, in my experience, different Trump voters have different motivations. But secondly, it's if you have an unflattering view of any large group of people, that is essentialism, right? I mean, that is...
Sure. Yeah, I just think, you know, look, it's more complicated than this, but ostensibly, what the left wants is for our systems, our institutions, and our interpersonal relationships, our culture, our society, our politics, to recognize the humanity, the dignity, and the beauty of all people equally. And that there are, I think it's important that we talk about, there are communities of people, groups of people, identities that have been historically rendered invisible and powerless. And in no way, shape, or form, what can get hard about a conversation like this is in no way, shape, or form is what Trump supporters, many Trump supporters feel that they're experiencing now, commensurate with centuries of institutional and structural disempowerment and oppression. And at the same time, feelings are feelings, and those feelings are somewhat authentic, somewhat ginned up by politicians and by certain arms of the media and social media. And so now you have people who are feeling like they don't matter, like are silenced and right. And one would hope, if we can put aside the compounding injustices of the right, like one would hope that I can see that. I can be self-critical enough, I hope, to know that there's something to rural white folks feeling kind of put down by coastal elites like me. Mm-hmm. That's really valid. I don't think it's as bad as slavery. But I can sort of chew and walk gum at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And find some compassion and just try to listen. Like, just try to actually listen to people so that they feel heard, that they feel understood, not just always listening to argue.
Yeah. In fact, I think sometimes there's a tendency among some people on the left to almost, assume that the hatred they see on the right is directed in the traditional ways you would see right-wing bigotry is directed toward minorities, toward gay people, whatever. And no doubt there's some of that. But I think there's a tendency almost to understand the extent to which the people on that side are doing the hating are hating people like us, like the people who, you know, the people they see as the founts of cosmopolitanism and political correctness and so on. But let me ask you a question about kind of large scale. In the book, you get into dramatic examples of hatred and of reconciliation. So you have a Palestinian who at one point was trying to kill Israeli soldiers, and later, even after, I gather, an Israeli soldier had killed his daughter or something, had an attitude that I don't think I would be able to muster toward Israelis after that, an incredibly forgiving attitude. You talk about Rwanda and actual genocide, and, you know, my first reaction was kind of, well, but how much relevance does that have to America today? Don't those examples mislead us into thinking that if we want to see the problem in ourselves, we should look for out-and-out rage, whereas the problem may be subtler than rage? But then I realized, you know, I think you're making the argument that some of the kind of kindling wood for fires like Rwanda is already been set afire. I mean, is that, I mean, tell me if that's going too far, but another thing I'm curious about, a related thing, is you're hearing the term civil war more often. It's usually used ironically, and they don't mean it quite seriously. It's that said, I think you're hearing it more often, and I don't expect the civil war tomorrow, but how bad do you think things could get in America? Could we have violence between large groups and so on, or what? You can respond to any.
I think it
more there than
no. I think, well, one of the more stunning moments for me in the book was when a refugee who survived the genocide in Rwanda, whose the majority of his family was slaughtered, who's now this guy's now a student in the United States, and he told me that a lot of what he'd seen in the run-up and read about and heard about in the run-up to the genocide in Rwanda, the propaganda of hate and dehumanization, he was seeing happening in the 2016 election, in particular on the part of Donald Trump and some of his supporters. And that's very chilling. And at the same time, what's interesting is I had conversations during the 2016 election and have had since, where folks on the left are very quick to imagine that the right could commit that kind of genocidal atrocity or some variation thereof, of whether it's, rounding up and locking up Muslims or immigrants it seems impossible to most on the left to imagine the left, us, doing something at that scale of horrificness. And, you know, I like to think that that's true. But it's interesting insofar as it suggests a sort of a fundamentally different, not just ideology, but sort of characteristic of humanity, right? They are inhumane and we are not.
Right.
And we never could be made to. And there's a philosopher I spoke with who said, you know, look, you don't have mass atrocities because of a handful of psychopaths. There weren't enough psychopaths in Germany or Serbia or Rwanda. You have mass atrocities because masses of people participate in them. People who were otherwise decent and good beforehand and who believe themselves to be decent and good afterwards. And so it's this illusion, interestingly enough, and apropos of what we were saying, it's this illusion of superiority. And then letting yourself off the hook. And, you know, especially now when we have social media at our fingertips. So if you and I say something nasty about the other side of the world, you know, we used to just keep it between us. But now it spreads like wildfire. Any of us can do it. And, you know, that's if we're always focused on the other side and their wrongs and how their wrongs justify any sort of egregious response on our part, and we don't even see it. We're not even sort of attuned to pay attention to our own hypocrisy. Look, that's some dangerous terrain. I still happen to think it's more dangerous for the right than the left, but, you know, look, hypocrisy and being blind to your own problems is never a good thing.
Okay, so quickly, we got two things. I know you got to leave soon.
Yeah.
One is we're gonna ask at the end for the quick answer to the question. What is the opposite of hate?
Oh yeah.
You mentioned there's an anecdote. When you bullied a girl, and it was a case where she was the official victim of bullying. And you know, there's something about the right around that age of 10 that where bullying, like marginalizing people, is a very public and overt thing. Like in my generation, maybe they're introducing, where there was always a kid who had cooties. And when I was 10 in fifth grade, it was Luann. Luann had cooties. And you would like say it in front, you know, I mean, she knew that she was the one with cooties, and people would go around touching kids and saying, you've got Luann's cooties. It's a weird and kind of sick thing. And I'm afraid.
Is it weird though?
What's
because,
that?
I mean, like we say it, like, you know what we say? We say, kids are kids. It's kids being kids. But you know what? It's a version of what we do as adults.
Oh, it's
right.
It's
Donald
horrible.
Trump voters have cooties. I mean, it's the same. Yeah.
And then as we get older, it gets subtler, and we do it behind their backs instead of in front of them. But you're right. It's kind of the same thing. So anyway,
but our kids hear us. Our kids always hear us.
So anyway, I guess what we have time for is you just to tell us what she said when you actually tracked her down after all these years and made contact with her. I don't know if you have the quote right in front of you. But
yeah, no, I don't have it right in front of me. But ostensibly, this woman told me, you know, that she didn't forgive me. And that the only way I could make up for what I'd done was to basically try to be a better person and try to prevent others from doing the same thing, which was part of what motivated me to want to scrutinize myself more broadly and write a book about my and others' experiences with hate and otherizing and dehumanization and demeaning people out of the hope that it would be some small repair.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to your final question, the opposite of hate.
Yep.
You did ask. You did tease it in the beginning beautifully. It is not love. In my book, literally, figuratively, you do not have to love someone to not hate them. You're welcome. You don't even really have to like them. You just have to understand that we're in some way, at some deep level, connected. That we are all human. That we all have an essential dignity, and to recognize that, and hopefully be able to experience that. That is both what the opposite of it is. It's also ultimately the cure.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for.
Thank you, Bob,
for doing this. You know, they say it's an ill wind that brings no man good. So I guess an upside of what you, whatever you did when you were 10 years old, however regrettable it is, there was an upside. It's this book, flowing ultimately kind of out of that experience in a sense. Thanks for taking the time. The book is The Opposite of Hate, A Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity, and people can buy it. They can follow you on Twitter at what? At, is it your name or what?
Sally Cohn, KOHN. On all forms of social media, Sally Cohn, KOHN.
Okay, wonderful. And then, of course, they can see you on CNN. Thanks a lot, Sally.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Thanks for making the time.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.